podcast is brought to you by Wildflower Zen Sangha. This Dharma talk was given by Roshi Amy Hollowell.
Good evening, everyone. It's very hot in Paris. It has been for a few days now. When we have these extremes like we do with temperature in France and Paris, I always think of this koan that we have, which is, you know, the student asks the teacher, where is the place where there is no hot and cold or something like that? And the teacher says, when it's hot, die to the heat. When it's cold, die to the cold. Or when it's hot, be hot. When it's cold, be cold. Something like that. Which is very difficult to do. Sounds very simple, but when it's very, very hot and you can't sleep, or when it's very, very cold and you don't have warm clothing, although heat, it's difficult. And yet, what the teacher says in that answer is the path of liberation. You know, we call this practice we call it generally, but I tend to refer to it as a practice of freedom, of liberation. And recently when we were in a teacher's meeting, someone asked the people who had received transmission or something what it was that we sought to teach. I think the question was something like that. And I really, you know, was trying to think, well, what is it? You know, what is the essential thing that this is about for me and that I try to transmit and share with people? And what it came down to for me was liberation. Liberation from what binds us, you know, what limits us. Liberation from our attachments. So that's what binds us, our attachments, to wanting it to be cold when it's hot and wanting it to be hot when it's cold. And that's a very simple one. We have many other things like that, that we want to be different or that we don't want to experience. And it all comes down to when we awaken, this is a practice of awakening to the wholeness of life. And when we awaken to that, then we're free. And that's the whole point. That's what this is all about for me. I read somewhere that in the practice of the forest monks in Southeast Asia, it's Theravadan tradition, they have a morning chant before their morning meditation, you know, like we have chants. And just a portion of it is the Dharma of liberation. This is, of course, translated, so it's probably not so exact, but the Dharma of liberation is immediate, open-handed, timeless, visible to the wise, to be experienced here and now by each person in their own heart. So the Dharma of liberation, it's immediate. It's right here, right now. It's open-handed. It welcomes everything. It's It's a practice. It's an experience of open-handedness, welcoming, timeless. It's as valid now as it was when the Buddha started talking about it in this way, as valid as it will be tomorrow or that it was last week. It's always there. It's visible to the wise, meaning that if you experience it, then you can see it. But if you haven't experienced it, then you don't see it. It might make sense intellectually, but as it adds, it's to be experienced here and now by each person in their own heart. So it's totally accessible to everyone at every moment. Visible, open-handed, right here, right now. However, you have to have an open heart for that. You know, you have to have open hands, but you also have to have open heart and open mind. If you don't, well, then you're still hanging on to your ideas about it, or you're still, I like this word, fettered. You're fettered. It's like what strings that bind you. This morning I had a writing workshop and there was a woman in it who, it was almost painful because she couldn't let go of her really firm beliefs about things. She started the workshop by saying, this woman was probably 75 years old, I don't know. Saying that she's an actress and a director and that she does a lot of plays and has always and writes and acts and presents and directs. And that she was doing this writing workshop because she's unable to write. She can only write from inspiration, from her personal inspiration. So if someone says, okay, this is the proposal, write about this, she can't do it, because it's not what she's inspired to write. And the idea of writing workshops is usually to help us free ourselves from those kind of attachments. We say, okay, write about this, and suddenly you find yourself really free. You can fill a whole page of something that you never would have written otherwise. It's a constraint that frees us. That's the idea with writing workshops. Similar to our sitting practice, where we have this form, and we just sit there and see what comes up. If we didn't sit there, then our mind would not be still and we might not notice a lot of things in our sitting practice. And so this woman proceeded to, with every proposal that was given for the writing, for a lot of the time, she would just sit there and stare at the page. She was unable to write anything. Or when she did write something, it had nothing to do really with the proposal. The subject of the workshop was a library in Paris, and the theme is inequality. And so all the writing was about inequality. And so she started out in her first exercise by saying, I don't like the word inequality. I don't agree with inequality. I like better justice and freedom, and there is no such thing as inequality, and all this kind of philosophical stuff, which was not at all what the proposal was. But she wrote that, and I said, okay, fine. You know, if that's what comes up with you, for you, that's the point, is to write, so write whatever comes. And she was unable to let go of these ideas that she had and just say, okay, forget my opinions and if I like the word equality or inequality or not. I had given very specific points to help with the writing, and she couldn't do it. And it was almost painful,
you know,
for me to witness it, because I could see so clearly where she was stuck. And yet there was nothing to be done, really, except continue helping, you know, offering the exercises and listening to what the other people had written and welcoming what she wrote, even if it wasn't really what the point was, the subject was. And she eventually, by the end, without acknowledging it, without really saying it, she ended up doing what the proposal was, the final proposal, and said that she really liked it. She really liked the workshop. I don't really know how free she felt, whatever. It doesn't matter so much. But what was interesting for me was to feel deeply her difficulty and where she was stuck, and see that she didn't know that. And that brings up a lot of compassion in me, because I know that this practice of liberation is exactly about that, liberating us from those kinds of attachments that limit us so much. Because we know when we feel limited or stuck, it's very uncomfortable. We might feel, you know, she might have felt, this woman, that she was maybe really happy with her position in the beginning. But I think the fact that she would sit there and stare at the blank page was a sign that it wasn't very comfortable, that something was, there was some kind of unease there. And I recognize that too. You know, we feel uncomfortable, but we don't know why. We're not satisfied with what's happening, but we don't know why. And this whole practice is about helping us to look into that, to free us from those situations, in those situations. But it requires us staying with it, like we always say, you know, staying with the pain or the discomfort. Because if we do, what we discover is that the pain or the discomfort will be reduced, eased, if we truly stay with it and welcome it, hold it with equanimity, as we say, meaning not judge it. So I'm feeling uncomfortable and I hate this feeling and I don't want to feel it, and so I try to push it away. Instead of, I'm feeling uncomfortable, I'm just going to stay with feeling uncomfortable and see what happens. Because immediately when we do that, there's an openness. That's that open-handedness that is referred to in the previous, you know, in the open-handed, immediate open-handed, timeless aspect of the path of liberation. So that's what our practice is about. Of holding the pain and the pleasure, holding the joy and the sorrow, with the open hearts. Which then allows us to experience the love that is always there. Yesterday was Bloom's Day, which is the day when James Joyce's great novel, Ulysses, takes place on June 16th, 1904. And so all these years, 117 years, has been, well, probably not since that day, but at least the past 100 years, maybe. No, because the book was published in 1922. So maybe the past 75 years, let's say. It's been celebrated as Bloomsday, the 16th of June, throughout the world. And I thought of, you know, one of my favorite, so I, on that day, I tried to think about the book and what, why it means so much to me. And a friend of mine in New York, who's is about as crazy about Joyce as I am, we always exchange emails on Bloomsday. And so I was thinking, so what is it about the book so much? And there's a lot of things, but there's this one line in it that lately, or in recent years, has taken on new meaning, and I quoted it before, I think, which is, love loves to love love. Which is just such a beautiful truth, you know? Love loves to love love. And we can recognize it. So when you're feeling love, you love it. And you love to love. And you love loving love. And actually, everything is, so if we can take it, and Joyce does kind of come to this point, it's a whole parrot from a paragraph, but, and I can't remember the whole paragraph. It's something like, you know, love loves to love, love. And then it's nurse so-and-so loves Bob the chemist. And so, you know, the bartender loves his wife, and the lady in the bookshop loves her dog. And it's all these, this person loves that person and all this. And it eventually comes to, and God loves all of, all creation or something like that. I don't know exactly what it is, but it comes down to this, there is only love. And so so I love someone, I'm actually loving love, because that person is love as well. And if we can connect with that, which we can, when we awaken to this wholeness of life, by not pushing away what we don't like. When we're sick, we're just sick. When we're cold, we're just cold. When we're hot, we're just hot. And then there's this vast, there's a space that opens, and this love for the world arises, and we realize that we're absolutely connected with, inseparable from everything and everyone. And that's liberation. We're not alone. We're not missing anything. We're not lacking anything. There is no better or worse. Everything is in its place. The beautiful snowflakes, they each fall in their own place. And this is to be experienced and can be experienced here and now by each person in their own heart. Where else could it be experienced? It's only right here, now, by you. It can't be experienced anywhere else. And then that changes how we behave in the world, and what we do and what we feel. It doesn't change the world, that's true. And yet, what we do then will change the world. I think about the Burning Grit Glassman, who created this whole enterprise, Greystone, because he looked around in the neighborhood where he had this magnificent Zen center. And the neighborhood, neighboring areas were poor and drug infested and plagued by AIDS and single mothers and homeless people, poverty. He said, "What, you know, this is crazy. What are we doing sitting here in this beautiful, marvelous Zendo with all of this stuff going on out there? This is pointless. What are we doing?" Because he did see the oneness. And he did experience the love, and he knew that what he was doing was not appropriate for the situation. So he sold the place eventually and started a business, started to bake brownies. And that way he could hire people, give people jobs in the neighborhood. And then for the single mothers who couldn't work because they had to take care of their children, he created a daycare center so that they could work making the brownies. And then so that the homeless people had places to live, he bought apartments and had hired some of the homeless people and the other people in the neighborhood to renovate the apartments, and then rented them at very low cost to the people who in the neighborhood, some of whom were working to make the brownies, but also others doing other things. Others who were being paid to renovate the apartments, others who were being paid to provide the healthcare. And then they created a hospice for people with AIDS. Just from this realization of the oneness of life and the overwhelming love that he experienced. And the slogan for Greystone now, which still exists. Bernie, of course, is dead, but he also was no longer associated with it. But the slogan for it is, "We don't hire people to bake brownies. We bake brownies to hire people." Which is very different. That comes from his deep realization of the oneness of life. Instead of sitting there on their cushions in their beautiful Zendo with the perfect Buddhas and doing the rituals exactly like they're supposed to be done with impeccable robes, they got up off their seats and they went out there and they made some brownies so they could hire people, give people work, give people homes, help them create their homes, help them build their lives. A lot of people left Bernie's Sangha at that time because they said, "This is not Zen." It was very controversial. To us today, it doesn't sound controversial, but at the time it was. No one had ever done anything like this before. All of that from his experience of seeing the oneness, seeing the pain first, seeing the suffering in the world, like me seeing that lady this morning suffering, and awakening to the wholeness and the oneness of life, and then seeing how what was called for to act, what was appropriate in that situation. Had he been living in a different community, he would have done something else, probably. If he hadn't been living near that area in New York that was so troubled, he would have probably done something else. This is what the Bodhisattva does. The Bodhisattva responds to the situation in accord with the experience of the oneness of life. So. What does that mean for us? You know, that this is the good news, that it's in the middle of your life, like I'm always saying, in the heart of your life, that we practice. You're each sitting in the Zendo, right where you are, in the meditation hall. Exactly where you are, whether it's your kitchen, your living room, your bedroom, office, wherever you are, whatever city, whatever country, that's the Zendo. And that's the heart of the practice right there, wherever you are. And how do you meet that? How do you greet that, your life? Do you welcome it with open hands? It says open-handed. Or do you complain and wish it were otherwise? And wish you had someone else's life? Or the opposite, think that your life is much better than someone else's. And not want to give anything up. What is it, maybe there's things in your life that are surplus. You know, what are your priorities? You know, what's really important? What are you hanging on to that, you know, really you might not need to do? We do, you know, we live in this world of multitasking and trying to balance a million things. And yet, you know, something is lost in that, because the great liberation is doing one thing well right now, fully. Someone told me the other day that he really regretted he didn't come last Thursday when Michelle Sensei was speaking, and we had talked about it earlier. I don't know if it was that day or another day, that he really wanted to come and that he was planning to come and whatever. And then he said, oh yeah, I mean, I feel really bad I didn't come. I forgot. I was out riding my bike, and when I remembered, it was too late. And I mean, I don't care, but I felt for him, because, you know, and so we talked about it, you know, priorities. So if something really has meaning for you, why do you do something else instead? You know? And if your life really is meaningful for you, why try to make it other than what it is? Do we really appreciate it? No. Do we really appreciate it? Maizumi Roshi said all the time, appreciate your life. Appreciate your life, appreciate your life. And what that means really is to see the wholeness of it. Because when you see the wholeness, when you see the oneness, it's not hard to appreciate it. It's just natural. It's the natural reaction that arises, is appreciation, when we see the oneness of it. the importance of each and every moment, each and every thing, each and every person. Maybe this guy riding his bike was important, and there's no reason that he shouldn't appreciate that. But he was feeling great remorse because he had wanted to do something else and he forgot. Of course, I couldn't imagine how you could forget. Say I'm in a different position. I'm the one who invited the guy, who invited Michelle to come. I'm the teacher of the Sangha, whatever. But it doesn't matter what our position is in the Sangha. I don't forget. This is my priority. It's funny, I was telling Joa recently, we were talking about when I first started teaching, right after I received transmission. And it's kind of embarrassing to say this, but we decided that we would sit on Monday nights at Joa and Delphine's apartment. This was decided before they invited me. They asked me to, if I wanted to do this, like maybe a month or two before my transmission. And it was a wonderful, generous offering. So we agreed that we would do it, and we said we would do it on Monday nights, and we started doing it. And in September, we started doing it. Nobody was there. I mean, the first night, I remember very, very well, it was Joa, Delphine, and Delphine's mother. And I think I have not seen Delphine's mother since then. This was like 17 years ago. And I don't even know why she was there. I think she was staying with Joa and Delphine for some reason. And so she was there and she came. And often it was like that. There was Joa and Delphine and me. And occasionally someone else would show up, but nobody knew about this. You know, it was like really, we had no publicity, nothing.
Which year was that?
2004. Christine came not long after, 2 years later, but she was one of the pioneers, actually. But anyway, so in those early days, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, but sometimes I forgot. Sometimes I forgot, oh, I'm supposed to be going to the sitting tonight. It's Monday. And I can't believe that I could forget. Now, I can't believe that I could forget it. But it hadn't yet entered I hadn't like yet owned my position, I think. I'm sure Joa and Delphine didn't forget. It was at their apartment. So they, you know, they couldn't forget. But I did, you know, and so I would call and say, I'm going to be late or something because I had forgotten. But and it wasn't like I forgot when I was, because I did live in a Zen center, right? And I knew all the meditation periods, and I didn't forget about meditation, but I think it had to do with like not owning my position or something, being the teacher. And so I understand how we can forget things. I get it. Or sometimes I have, you know, interviews scheduled with people and then they don't show up. And then they write me 3 hours later and say, oh, I overslept. Or they write me the night before and say, well, I'm really tired. I think I would prefer to sleep tomorrow morning than have an interview. And I understand all that stuff. It happens. You know? It happens. But do you have this deep burning desire in you to awaken? And if you do, then don't let anything stop you. Because awakening to that oneness, that non-duality, it's the absolute liberation. And that's why I sit here and do this, and that's why, you know, that's why I bake brownies. to wake people up, to help people wake up. I don't seek to help people wake up so they will bake brownies. So, Buddha, I'll let you say something. If you want to.
Well, can you hear me properly? Yeah. I'll start. I have a shameful confession to make. today I went for a walk. I hadn't really gone out since I came back from a week with Roshi in the country. Where we used to do when we did walks every day. So I thought I really need to go for a walk. And I'm in Paris right now. So I went for a walk in my neighborhood. And the experience was actually very strange. I noticed that each time I was passing in front of a shop, I wanted the things in the shop. I passed a bakery. I wasn't hungry, but I thought, oh, ooh, that looks good. I would eat that. Then I saw a shop from where they had stuff from Portugal with really nice pottery. I was like, oh, that I would love that. And then it went on and on and on and on and on. And for an hour and a half that I walked around, I was hammered by my own desires. It was really painful. It was really exhausting. And I really paid attention to that and kept thinking, yeah, this is what I do. And this is why I don't like walking around Paris, I think, now anymore, because I'm swamped by all kinds of desires just walking around and seeing the stuff and wanting things that I don't even really want, really. So that has to do with what we talked about, what Roshi talked about. It didn't feel still inside, and it didn't. There was an excitement that didn't feel very healthy, and I could see it, and it reminds me now of the story with the Dalai Lama going through LA in his car and going through this kind of 42nd Street kind of type area where they had electronic products, and he just felt he wanted it all without even knowing what it was about. And I felt a little bit like that, like wanting things that really had no relevance whatsoever. I wasn't hungry. I wasn't just, and that's not even mentioning the girls also in the middle of this heat of this beautiful woman walking around. So Mara was present and it was very hard to just sit there and it's like, this is me. This is my shameful confession of the day.
Well, and to differing degrees, we can relate that to our experience sitting too, because all kinds of stuff comes up and we get involved with it in our sitting, and our mind is like chattering away and imagining things and fantasizing, and we do the same thing. You know, that's kind of just a really concrete example of what we do. Debbie?
I'm having a really hard time with this wanting everything to be different right now. Particularly with, I'm a volunteer for the Petit Cloudy Pool. They're all old, sick, and poor. That's kind of the definition of the Petit Cloudy Pool. We just went to check a vacation home, which would be a perfect place to do a retreat. It's the most beautiful abbey in the Berry, which is not that much. It's a little bit like the Morvan. The Berry, it's boring, but this abbey is fabulous. Huge, there are horses, black rooster and hens and stuff. That was our mission. In the meantime, the people that are there are not, these guys were not only were they old and sick and poor, but they were defined as grande précarité. They're from the 18th arrondissement. They don't come from some foreign country. And they start telling their stories as we were eating with them last night. And I'm mad. I've been mad about this since I was 12. Why do such nice people, but even nasty people, but why do nice people suffer so much? This, where we asked one guy where he was from, he's Afghani. He was in an Afghani prison for 2 years. And I think he was trying to stay in a rather light, it was a beautiful evening, we were eating together, but Afghani prison is not a fun topic. And it was all like that. And I had a friend telling me about his problems with the police recently. I could feel the same thing of, it's not fair, and this is not right, and why does this have to happen? And I'm almost given up on what can I do about it, because in the case of old sick people, there's not going to be a good outcome. You just buried one. It's going to get worse. So I can make up all kinds of things about have a nice day, but it's a downhill job sort of thing. But as you were talking, I thought, okay, but if I take it to that, I don't know how to accept this in any sort of, I don't know how to stop being angry about it. Even if I can stop being, power trippy about, well, I'll fix it for you. Let me fix it for you, which I know is untrue. I can't fix old age, and I can't fix people going to prison. And even if I can put that aside, I'm still sort of this, I'm on the life isn't fair sort of thing. And while I'm listening, I'm sort of getting my fist ready, you know, you see what I'm going to do about this. What am I going to do about this? Zero. But you know what I mean? I'm all worked up. I can't just walk away from it and say, hot is hot and cold is cold. And I think there is a way to do this better, at least myself. And I don't want to stop. It's not so awful that, you know, sometimes it's fun being old, sick people. They can be very funny. It's not unbearable, but I was watching myself last night thinking, there must be a better way to do this for myself, and probably for the guy too. I mean, there's no, all my ire is not helping him out. He's not in prison anymore. So listening to this sort of, I don't know, it's kind of this tough guy. I happen to work in the tough guy about fate or whatever it's called. So what am I? Problem.
So you say you think there is a way to do it. What might that be?
That was my question, if you don't mind. How do I, what would be, I mean, even if I'm meditated, or recently I've been saying, well, just breathe instead of, because I can, it's very physical. I'm pissed off. So how do I listen to this? And I like listening to people's stories. It's something I've always liked. How can I have this material be presented and not be so reactive, not be so angry?
Because the anger is related to what, like injustice or...
Why the nicest people suffer the most or, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It's not even... I used to think I was mad at God, but I'm not even sure I know what God is. But just, yeah, this shouldn't work like this sort of thing.
Yeah, I think we can all relate to what you're saying. And the key word in there is shouldn't. You know, we have this idea of how things should be, which are usually how we want them to be. And, you know, the fact is we're all going where those old sick people are going. That's the reality that we all will encounter. Old age, sickness, and death. Those are the three biggies that the Buddha, you know, pointed out, which he didn't discover anything. He just chose to express things within those terms, but that's where we're all going. Someone I read recently, Roshi Uchiyama, I think, said, practice is active participation in loss. It's not like, it's kind of hard to understand what that means, but it's the word active is very interesting, and participation is interesting too, because loss, yes, we all know that, right? We lose our youth, we lose our health, we lose our life, what we think of as our life. We lose people we love. We lose things we love. We lose partners. We lose jobs. We lose all kinds of things. So practice is active participation in that. What, you mean we're supposed to be losers? Is that what it's saying? No. It's saying that life, life as it is implies the end of life. You know, it's impermanent. It's ever changing. And so something is always being lost. At the same time, if we can appreciate just what is, then the loss, we can appreciate the loss as well. Sounds really conceptual, but you know, if I can appreciate my kitten just how she is, then I can appreciate that she's already grown in the month I've had her. She's changing all the time. She's not going to stay this little kitten like that. But the best thing I can do, the most wholehearted thing I can do, is to wholly appreciate her as she is now. And then I lose nothing. Because then when she's different, I will wholly appreciate her that way too. And I don't lose anything. In the case of, okay, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? So then we have big judgments about bad things and good things, which obviously there are things that, you know, Afghan prison, as you say, is probably not a happy occasion. So what do we do then with that? The best thing we can do is to fully appreciate that person here and now, welcome whatever he's sharing, because as soon as we add anger onto it, then that changes our experience of what he's saying. And that changes our experience of the world then. As you say, you can carry around this anger. Whereas if you just, okay, that's what it is right now, it doesn't mean we like it. It's not about being passive or being unfeeling. Can we channel that anger without hanging onto it, indulging in it? Can we channel that into then, like what you're doing, you know, doing this work with these people? That changes their lives, even if it doesn't maybe seem like it immediately. And maybe they don't express it that way, but they're, you know, they're being given an opportunity to be have someone present with them in a different way than a neighbor or their cousin or their children even, or they don't have any family. A lot of times in this kind of organization, they don't have any family, you know? And so can you channel that anger you're feeling and not indulge in it, but use that as the fuel for your bodhisattva act that you're doing by serving, by being present, listening with the whole heart, doing what needs to be done, you know, like traveling, going to see a place where they can go on vacation. You know, that's really, instead of just you going on away on your vacation to the, you know, to the Caribbean, you go and you look at a place where someone else can have a good holiday. I mean, that's a great bodhisattva act. Yeah.
Well, thank you, but do you think I'll ever stop being mad?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's so much about stop being mad. It's just being with the madness in a different way. You don't have to stop it. The anger, you know, I mean, yeah, I'm angry about a lot of things in the world. But you know, and someone in this writing workshop today was talking about the camps and quoting Elie Wiesel, who's, you know, said something, she had some beautiful quote from him, but something about, no, there is no God because he would not have allowed the camps to happen, the Holocaust to happen. I don't know what God they're talking about. You know? And I don't really, since I didn't read that, I don't know what he actually said. But I suppose if you believe in a God that will make everything perfect and beautiful and happy, then you would say that there is no God, or that God has betrayed you because he's, you know, made these horrible camps and created the Holocaust and killed, you know, millions of people.
If I may say, Debbie, in what you're saying also, it makes me think feel that in that type of anger, behind it is actually an expression of love. If you like, you know, the desire for people to be happy, or the desire for equality, it's actually a desire for, it's a manifestation of love, in fact. So I wonder if we go back to the true meaning of that anger, which is the love and the willingness to help and the willingness to do good, if we can stay with that instead of, how can we go back to that first intention of doing good instead of unfolding it to something that might be actually unhealthy for oneself and also for the other.
Yeah, good point. And all the practices of what they call metta, and you know this, Debbie, metta and Tonglen and whatever. You know, one of the things is may all beings be happy. Sometimes it feels really fake. And you kind of just repeat these phrases. But there is, like Joa says, you know, there is some truth to it. And there really is, because that's really what we want. Everybody wants to be loved. Everyone wants to be happy. Everyone. And love loves to love love. You know, so, and when it's feeling contrarié, you know, when it's feeling like it's not happening, then that's anger, you know. So that's a good point, Joa. We're like out of time. It's maybe a good place to end. Unless someone wants to add one thing.
If you have enjoyed this Dharma talk, just give us a visit on wildflowerzen.org.